Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. Today is the 30th of March, 2015, and today we're talking not to someone halfway around the world for a change. We're talking to someone in my own neck of the woods here in Japan, in the land of the rising sun, a fellow English teacher who has just published a new book for little people, as he puts it on his website, crims.com. We're talking to Simon Crims, the author of a book that he was kind enough to send me a copy of in the mail, Roller Dog. A very, very interesting little book. So, Simon, first of all, thank you very much for joining us on the program today.
No, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for the book. More to the point, this is an excellent little book that I can personally recommend because, I do have a copy. Actually, I have two copies sitting around here, which myself and my son have looked through on at least a couple of dozen occasions right now. And there's so many great things about it. But let me read the introduction to this book on your website because I think it pretty much encapsulates it very well. It says, Roller Dog is a book designed for little people growing up in the brave new world order of the 21st century. Rather than instilling fear in young minds, the storyline about Humphrey the Roller Dog creates an image of hope. However, the pictures, which are crafted for deeper interpretation by adult readers, compose a message of warning. All very much an apt description of the book, which is available for free download as a PDF on crims.com, and of course also available for purchase as a hardcover or a hardcover and softcover?
Yep, hardcover and softcover, yes.
All right, excellent. Okay, well, first of all, let's just hear a little bit about yourself. What inspired you to create this book?
Well, we arrived in Japan at the same time, James, I think 2004. And my story is very similar to yours. I'm Australian, and internet in my home in Australia was terrible. And so coming to Japan, having broadband, really allowed me to have real access to the internet for the first time. And Loose Change, second edition, in May 2005, just a link that I found on the internet. And so I started down that rabbit hole and really got into 9/11 for about 3 years and thought that was just the only thing, really.
Yeah.
And then what really started me doing the children's book stuff was Thomas Keane, 9/11 commissioner, who at that time was touring the United States, I think, teaching elementary school teachers how to tell children about 9/11. And it really made me sick to my stomach.
Yeah.
And so I started writing a book solely about 9/11. And then decided at that time, I think a lot of us, when we first woke up, really felt, you know, it was just it's going to be next week or next month and this is going to, you know, it's all going to come out, right? Everybody, you know, or at least that was my view in that time.
So that was the direct impetus. But then as you got time and perspective, it started to sink in that it wasn't all going to be about 9/11, I presume.
Yeah, it was when I started getting into the economic side of things and seeing how much had actually been hidden. I found that the book solely about 9/11 really wasn't satisfying for me. So I wrote this Roller Dog book, which I could sort of use to, you know, go over more issues with.
It's funny because if memory serves correctly, I believe there was an edition of the 9/11 Commission Report as a comic book that was issued to try to, you know, dumb it down for the public, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, so perhaps appropriate that we take it on from the other perspective. So who is really the core intended audience for a book like this?
The story itself is designed for little people, for children, and I don't really believe that we should be telling children, instilling fear in them. So I wanted to try and create something which was dualistic in that, you know, children can enjoy it at a very simple level, and probably I don't know, I've heard children do get a sort of feeling that something is wrong from the pictures, and of course, adults are the intended audience for the pictures themselves.
Right. And I can attest that I think you've hit the mark there, because even with my 2-year-old boy, he loves all the pictures of the animals and looking at them, but is, of course, scared of the Congress critter, who is depicted as some sort of blubber beast or something. So appropriately so, afraid of the politician, I think. And of course, at the end, when they get to the beach of, you know, the nirvana of voluntarist society, it's a wonderful scene, and everyone's happy, and my son loves it as well. But I can also attest that there really is that deeper level to these pictures, and even after a dozen or two dozen or whatever it is readings now, every single time I notice little details in the pictures that I didn't notice before. So you've obviously put an incredible amount of work into this. How long did it take to actually put this together?
6 years, 6.5 years actually. But I mean, that's working full time and doing it after work and on weekends. Yeah, in the last 3 years, I mean, after having children, you know, something changes in your biology, and you sort of become more, well, dedicated to causes, perhaps. And that's what really sort of switched me on to finish the book. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome to hear. And it is, I mean, it is such a life-changing experience in so many different ways to have children. And there's, I mean, I think from my own perspective, you understand in some sort of conceptual way about, you know, fighting for the future of humanity. But when you actually have a living, breathing specimen growing up in your household, it puts it into a perspective that maybe it didn't have before, and puts a certain intensity to it.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Which is why it is so important to be introducing these topics to the younger generation. But it is such a difficult thing to do, because, of course, we are inundated 100% every day from so many different angles by all of the mainstream programming on these issues. And then trying to open up this whole other can of worms as to what's going under the surface, it can be a fear-inducing process, depending how it's done. So I like the fact that you have obviously taken time to try to not make this such a fearful book. But it is a balancing act to do that. Tell us a little bit about that process, about making this not about fear induction.
Well, if I can just go back to what you were saying before about focusing, or not so much focusing, but really paying attention to youth. Children, let's say, a 10-year-old child now, we really tend to, I think, in what would you call it, the truth movement or whatever this is, this sort of new enlightenment, we tend to miss the fact that in another 5 or 10 years, I mean, these kids are going to be adults, right? There's so much attention paid to educating other adults, and those who we are sort of trying to work against have been focusing on children for a very long time. And I wanted to create something where the children would have a once somebody gets older and starts becoming aware of deeper issues within the politics and economics and stuff like that, actually have an emotional background from their childhood. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Because it tickles me pink to think that, you know, 15 or 20 years from now, my son's going to be looking at this book and saying, wow, my dad was reading this to me when I was 2? That's great.
I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that must be the intended effect, because, as you say, there is so much time spent on arguing, essentially, with adults over, you know, people who have long since been so bought into the programming that a lot of them, unfortunately, just aren't willing to look at a different perspective, that not a lot of time is given to the next generation, which is obviously the most important thing that we can do as parents, is to try to deprogram our children from all of that those other influences that are going to come in. Given how important this task is, why do you think there aren't more people engaged in it right now?
Fear, maybe, is what I, by fear, I mean, I think if you look at periods of history, say the 1960s, for example, where dissent was really kind of quite easy, you know, there was a lot of comfort within the society. And at this present time, even people who are not particularly aware of political issues or truth or whatever you want to call it, do have a certain unease about what is occurring right now, I think. And so a lot of sort of artists or people who would create culture I think going along with the flow rather than actually stepping outside of the collective in a way, or stepping outside of what would be acceptable thought, acceptable culture.
Well, that's so noticeable, especially in music. I mean, you think to the music of the counterculture of the 60s and 70s, and of course it was all about, you know, rebelling against the political status quo at the time. Even if it was rebelling in perhaps controlled ways, it was still very explicitly against that. But you look today and there's no musicians out really on the mainstream scale that are talking about these issues. I think in the exact same way, I mean, it filters down to every level, including books like this and the conversation that we have with children. And perhaps that's because there wasn't that kind of conversation going on a generation ago, that there aren't enough people right now realizing how important it is to have that conversation with children in this day and age.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the cultural thing, I mean, it's not just in literature, is it? It's like you say, across music, it's in many, many realms where, I mean, people are really seem to be quite hesitant to dissent. I mean, you're a Gen Xer, right? So, I mean, you remember you're also a Smashing Pumpkins fan, as am I. the types of music which were coming out in the 1990s were quite dissident in a way, right? Mm. I mean, compared to what is mainstream now.
Compared to the treacly pop crap that has inundated us for a couple of decades now? Yes, yes. I mean, even if it wasn't explicitly political per se, there was obviously some sort of dissent that was encaptured in that.
Certain dissatisfaction.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I remember growing up, a lot of reading all the music critics talking about how, oh, every time there's a recession, there's this kind of, you know, outbreak of, you know, rock music. And that's, you know, that was what happened with the grunge era and all of that. Well, of course, that's, I think, been pretty much disproven over the last several years. And the return of recessions. But it is interesting to think about this kind of cultural tide that may come and go. But if that's the case, we haven't really seen that leading edge of dissent coming back in recent years. And I think you're right. I think fear is part of that equation for sure, because what is different between now and even 20 years ago, let alone 50 years ago, it's the explicit ways that the government is now basically getting everyone aware of and used to the fact that they're being surveilled and tracked and databased and watched over. And yes, there is a police state. And yes, we are arming the police with military equipment and things of that nature that I think really does create a different context for this. So I can understand from that perspective why even artists shy away from this kind of direct approach. And to be fair, perhaps there are other ways artists can do this. They don't necessarily have to take on political issues head on. It can be sort of dissent in more subversive and hidden ways. But I think it is important that we do have this type of material as well, with very explicit painting of the picture, I think, in, as I say, the Congress critters and the other beings that populate this dystopian world, I think, are more accurately reflective of our reality. I guess the question going forward then is...
Could I ask you a question, James?
Yes, please.
So definitely fear plays a role. What about apathy? I mean, this digital era, these things...
Right.
They breed apathy. They really do.
Yes.
I mean, this is my new iPhone 6, and I love it.
Oh, yeah. Have you got the Touch ID enabled?
My tracking device. But, I mean, it does breed a lot of apathy. I mean, even though you see it feels like you're terribly, you know, switched on and clued into what's going on. Yeah.
It's true. I mean, we've obviously lost some of the human connection that enabled things like protest movements of the past. And yes, you can have a protest movement online, but it is obviously a different phenomenon entirely. And yes, it does lead to people being less willing and able to talk about these issues in public with other people. People will have fiery debates online about these types of issues and then go sheepishly off and agree with what most people are saying around in their actual real life. And I think that disconnect is widening, if anything. So I think you're right. I mean, there's a technological role to this. There's the fear and the apathy. And that makes an extremely powerful 1-2 punch. Again, I mean, it's an uphill battle for a lot of artists who want to come into this to do something about it. And I think the other factor in this is that, of course, there is always the over... There's always been, for the last 100 years of mass media, there's always been the corporations that control what is published, etc., that have made it so impossible, which is why, as people who have seen my work recently will know, of course, it's about connecting peer-to-peer and getting around those traditional gatekeepers, which is now really, truly possible, as people like yourself are proving, with the free download of the PDF of this book. I mean, you can go and see it and then hopefully purchase an actual physical copy, not only to support the artist, but to read to your children rather than to show them an iPad or something version of it. But yeah, I mean, that is hopeful in so many ways. And I think it is happening. But the problem is there are so few or so disparate kinds of places for these types of artists to get their word out about what they're doing, that it can be difficult, which is something I try to do on the podcast when I can, truth music and those types of things. But I think we need more places for artists like yourself to get this type of work recognized, because it's not going to happen in the New York Times or whatever. There's never going to be a review of this type of information somewhere like that. And I guess the question then is, do you as an artist know of other venues for artists to be distributing work like this or getting attention to this type of work?
No. Yeah, unfortunately not. I mean, I think there's definitely potential for it within the internet, of course, but yeah, I think in very early days. Yes. Yeah.
Well, let's put this out then. I mean, we're not talking to each other here. We're talking to people all over the globe and, of course, corporate part members. Let's put the word out there for people to think about. What are venues? What are places where artists like yourself, independent and underground and countercultural artists, can get the word out about their work? I mean, is it somewhere like a Reddit conspiracy subreddit or something, I don't trust Reddit, really. I know it's controlled in a lot of different ways, but it might be a possible venue, or there's a million different places where people could potentially get the word out about this. And I think we have to start taking the impetus to do that and support people like yourself, because I really think that this is at least as important as the sort of dry presentation of news and facts and that type of thing, which is also important. But people respond on a very visceral level to art and music and things of this nature. And I think if we just cede that battleground to the Hollywood industry and whatever, we've already lost the game in a lot of ways. I mean, it's so important for us to take this up and to support people who are trying to do this in a different way. I guess then I would like to ask you, do you know of other artists who are doing this type of work that you think deserve more attention?
There's an Australian woman who wrote a book, How the Towers Fell, or something. I'm not sure the title. It was linked to on Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So there is that kind of thing. There is that. That's the only other book that I know which was dealing with 9/11 per se. There's a few other books, only focusing on children's books, which have talked about, you know, we shall not be chipped or you know.
Oh, right. Yes. Catherine Albrecht wrote a children's book. Yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah, I forgot about that. See, even me, I know about these things and I still, yeah, it's interesting. This is, a potential cultural phenomenon that we could help foster if there were more venues for people to get the word out about this. So it's something to at least think about.
Early days, yeah.
Yeah, well, if Corbett Report members, again, have any ideas about this or even how we can help in the dissemination of this type of work, it would be appreciated, because I think this is so important to do. All right, Simon.
Can I just go back to what you said before?
Please do.
You said that this type of work, or art, is as important as, media presentations like you do. And I really believe that as well. So many people have their world shaped not by the information they actually have access to, but by the cultural water they're swimming in. And we the truth movement, what would you call it? What do you call it?
Oh, you're going to put me on the spot. That's a good question. I actually dislike the truth movement.
Yeah, I dislike it too.
There is a lot of cultish aspects to a term
yes,
like
it
that.
Is. Yeah. But what people understand what I think what we're talking about, right? It's sort of enlightenment or you know, internet revolution or whatever you want to call it, is very focused on informational, information on news. And I really think that if more cultural material is created, I mean, I sort of consider you a primary producer of, I mean, fantastic media. And my book has been very influenced by you and others. I'm sort of a secondary, you know, I don't have the brain to be able to do the type of research you do. So I am a sort of secondary producer, right? And if more people are able or do this kind of cultural work, I really think that it will actually have quite a big effect on the people who are not accessing this type of information just because they're sort of, well, they've been rendered unable perhaps by television or by what,
mm-hmm.
yeah, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Just don't have the attention span to be able to sit through a podcast or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely true. And it's funny that you bring that up because I personally am intensely jealous of anyone who can draw, as someone who can barely put together a stick figure that looks reasonable. You know, so obviously the types of illustrations in here are so, I mean, extremely in-depth. I mean, there's so many layers to this that I'm very, very jealous of your talents as well. So there you go. And as you say, I mean, this is the other point that I always stress, that I have a particular style of delivery that works for some people, doesn't work for others. I don't care. It's who I am. I'm just being me. If you have a different talent, if you have a different way of presenting this information, please use it. And people like yourself are doing that. And I'm always so pleased to see it, because there will be people who can be reached by this type of work that cannot be reached by the type of work I do. And it's only through us working together that we can ever hope to really change the societal conversation. And as you say, the cultural side of this is so important to a society that's steeped in entertainment and sort of glitz. I think people will respond often much better to this type of broaching of the conversation than just a podcast about news and politics. So again, my hat's off to this work, and I think we should direct people once again to the website, crims.com, where they can find out more about this work. Are there any other points you'd like to make about this or about where we're headed as a society?
Where we're headed as a society.
That's a bit too broad, isn't it? Well, how about this? Where are you headed with your work? Are there any other plans for future additions to this series?
Not the Roller Dog. No, there's another book in the works, the one that I mentioned before, which is solely about 9/11, which I kind of consider a bit of a linchpin in a way. I mean, you can go up and start talking to people about fractional reserve banking and really not make any headway. But, you know, show somebody just some simple facts about 9/11 and you can open eyes more easily.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're headed as a society, where do you think, James? I actually have a lot of apprehension. I feel like there's something big coming in the works, but, I mean, it's just a kind of gut feeling without any real basis to it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, neither of us can predict the future, but if I wasn't apprehensive, I wouldn't be doing this work.
Yeah.
And if I didn't think there was any chance of hope, I wouldn't be doing this work. So there's some sort of balance in there between optimism and pessimism, or at least the idea that there's some future in which this new world order doesn't have to happen, or at least doesn't have to happen the way they want it to happen. And if there's any way that I can insert myself in that mix, that's why I'm here doing what I'm doing. I'm assuming that's why people listen to this podcast rather than just some sort of fear porn, daily dose of fear porn or something. I assume people listen because they think there is something, some way we can help shape this or steer this away from the crevice, the precipice. It's not going to be an easy task. And yeah, I think there's a lot of reason to be apprehensive about this and where things are going. And all we have to do is imagine a scenario where a 9/11 type event played out tomorrow. I mean, can you imagine how much further along the road to the complete takeover we would be at that point? I certainly don't want to. And again, we're always just a couple of crises away from the next stage of this larger crisis. So yes, a lot of reasons to be apprehensive, but That is for a future Simon and James conversation, or a future version of ourselves to contemplate. For the time being, let's direct people to RollerDog once again at crims.com. Simon, thank you again so much for doing this and for providing my family directly with something that we can take on into the future to help us hopefully deprogram some of the other cultural influences that are out there. And let's again encourage other people out there to do the same. Simon, thank you again for your time today.
No, thank you, James.